Welcome to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Paul Lawrence, the co-chairman of the IBM Endowment for the Business of Government. We created the endowment in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. Find out more about the endowment by visiting us on the web at www.businessofgovernment.org. The Business of Government Hour features a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. Our special guest this morning is Carrie Dominguez. Carrie is the chair of the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Good morning, Carrie.
Good morning, Paul. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you for joining us. Could you tell us a little bit more about the EEOC and its mission?
EEOC has a very unique mission. It's a keeper of the laws that enforce non-discrimination in the workplace. The Age Discrimination and Employment Act, the Americans with Disabilities Act, the Equal Pay Act, Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, all of these are statutes that are enforced by the commission.
Now it is a commission as opposed to just a government agency. Why is that?
The EEOC was created as part of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. We actually became operational in 1965. Back then, we had no experience whatsoever with issues relating to employment discrimination. And so it was determined that we needed a body of regulators, individuals, primarily attorneys, that would look at class issues, patterns and practices, and discriminatory behavior, and would then take these issues, what we call commissioner's charges. That's how the whole development of EEO case law came about, primarily through commissioner's charges, the identification of discriminatory practices. And then the commissioners, it's a five-member commission. The commissioners would then direct the investigations as well as the selection of these employers to pursue non-discrimination issues. And so that's how it evolved, and that's how the commission has played a very critical role in the development of EEO case law in our history.
Now, you're the chair. What are your duties and responsibilities as chair of the commission?
Essentially, the chair sets the direction for the commission. I'm appointed, nominated by the president, confirmed by the Senate. It's a five-year term, five commissioners. Each has a five-year term. And the chair serves as the CEO of the commission. I am in charge of all of the management, day-to-day direction and guidance, setting up the strategic framework, the operational management practices, et cetera, that I would expect all of our employees to operate under. And then issues that relate to lawsuits and policy development are handled by the commissioners. They bubble up to the commission. I present them to the commissioners for vote. And so that's pretty much it. So I'm a voting commissioner, but at the same time, I have the added responsibilities of running the agency.
Now, tell us about your previous experiences before joining the commission.
Prior to joining the commission, I was a small business entrepreneur. I ran my own management consulting business that involved a variety of things. I did executive recruitment, executive search. I also did served as expert witness on glass ceiling issues. I did a lot of workforce preparedness assessments for employers, looking at the competencies of their employees and then making some recommendations. So I was an entrepreneur. And then prior to that, I was a partner with the two major international search firms. I always believe in the power of one, and I chose to go into the search business because I felt that people do influence the direction of an organization by the individuals that you appoint to positions of leadership. Prior to that, I was a political appointee in the Bush 41, the 41st president administration. I was assistant secretary of labor, as well as director of the Office of Federal Contract Compliance Programs. And prior to that, I was at Bank of America in charge of director of executive programs, in charge of what we call the caring and the feeding of the top 200 executives at the bank. I did all the executive staffing, executive compensation, benefits, succession planning, all of those things. And I think the theme that runs through my career, regardless of whether it's weaving in and out of the public and private sectors and independent sectors, has to do with human resources and the value of our human capital in driving change, in improving performance in an organization. And, you know, you can have the best laid out technology and business processes, but if the people aren't included, aren't part of it, aren't the ones driving it, you're going to still continue to have mediocre results. So whatever position I've held has always been with the focus of the importance of human resources, of our people, in being in the driver's seat.
Do you think that's a widely understood theme now?
I think it's getting to be much more widely understood. I recall the about 7-8 years ago when we started delayering organizations, and we became so bereft of talent that all of a sudden corporate America had to hurry up and once again look at the critical competencies and the talent that they had lost. So I do think it's important, and it's much more important now when we are always playing catch up in the marketplace and looking for ways to be more competitive and drive improvements and be more profitable.
Do you think this is appreciated in government as well?
The government has never had a competitor per se. We've been somewhat insulated from the pressures of the marketplace, from the demands of our customers, but that's no longer so. We're now as concerned about being competitive, particularly under the president's management agenda and his commitment to make sure that if we are going to outsource, that we can at least be as competitive as the entities that, to which we may end up outsourcing. So we're beginning to realize the value of having prepared, skilled, knowledgeable individuals driving these changes and the importance and the efficiency of our operations. Even though we don't generate a revenue per se, we are entrusted. So yes, I do think that the government in general is looking at ways to drive improvement and attract the best talent and develop the talent that we have. For so long, we've had silos in government, and even though the people are so dedicated and so hardworking and so committed. The commission, for example, we have some of the longest tenured employees. We have individuals that have been there since the doors opened back in 1965. So it's important that we keep people with broadening their skills, development. Yes, people do matter.
You've had a variety of different experiences when you were describing your career. I wonder if there's any one particular challenge that you think best prepared you for your present position.
Well, one of the challenges that I look back on, which is a transformational experience, was when I was director of the Office of Federal Contra-Compliance Programs. When I arrived there, it was an entity that was not really, did not have a good image of itself. I felt that they were just kind of going through the motions without really a sense of focus of purpose. And we identified an opportunity that we could really establish the relevance of that program, and that came out through the Glass Ceiling Initiative. Glass ceiling, by the way, is a definition that talks about the syndrome that you seem to be rising and rising, but somehow you can't get to the top of a corporate ladder because there's an invisible barrier that's getting in the way, and you just kind of bump against the ceiling, but you don't know what it is. So we decided that we needed to be at the table, and we needed to participate along with the shareholders and with the customers and with the employees, and said the federal government has a role to play. And just by having that initiative, it caused almost a miraculous turnaround in the sense of value and self-esteem and interest that our employees generated, because for once they felt themselves part of an important societal issue, and they saw themselves as catalysts in improving changes in the society. So that was a very, very positive experience, and I should say that it's been an initiative that's been carried throughout both administrations, Republicans and Democrats.
You've moved from the private sector to the federal government and back again both ways. I'm curious, how would you contrast the two sectors in terms of their approach to management?
Well, quite different. In fact, I arrived in the private sector, I think, in the best and the worst of times. I was there. I worked for banking at the time when we went from 1,200 branches down to 800, when we were downsizing and restructuring. And I recall the first 2 years reporting to 6 different managers. I'd go to lunch, come back, I had a different manager. It caused me to be adaptable and flexible and nimble. It caused me to be sensitive to the business changes that were going on, and the recognition that our employers, the employer, and all of other peer companies had to follow the market requirements, what the customers wanted, what the marketability, you know, the alliances and the kinds of things that make an organization not only profitable but responsive to the needs of the society. So one of the things that I noticed was how quickly we changed in the private sector. It was just a survival, and it was a need in order to stay viable. Unfortunately, in the government, we haven't had that sense of emergency, that sense of we need to be responsive to the customer, because we haven't had any competitors. It's been a self-contained entity. We're beginning to see that sense of competition and that sense of, okay, so we've made great progress. And yes, we're lucky and fortunate to have had the pleasure of all this time to think about ways of improving it without the external pressures. But the time has come now when we have to keep asking more of ourselves and when our own taxpayers and customers are asking more of us. So I do think that the culture that we have had, one that is bureaucratic, many, many layers of checks and more checks and counter checks, when you've had individuals who even with their desires to move and broaden, find themselves sort of stymied in the same career path without ability to broaden their base of knowledge and skills and career-building experiences, we find that that is a detriment now to our dedicated employees, and we need to break up all those barriers and give them an opportunity to broaden their base.
That's a good stopping point. We've got to go to a break. Rejoin us in a few minutes as we continue our discussion with Carrie Dominguez of the EEOC. Do you know what the Commission's 5-point plan is? We'll ask Carrie to tell us more about it when the Business of Government Hour returns.